I was all alone. My times of trouble and pain. I used to think there was no one else who felt the cold and rain. Then I woke up to humanity.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to another edition of The Balancing Point. You're listening to John Neters, Doctor of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. And I will be here to talk with you, to listen to you, to engage with you for the next hour, and look forward to having some time with you. I understand that there's already someone on the phone, so let's get them on right away. Good morning. Hello?
Good morning, Dr. Neters.
Hi, how are you?
My name is Carolyn. I live in Hayward, and what I would like to ask you a question about today is that I have been recently diagnosed with pleural mesothelioma, and I was wondering if in your long career you have come across this, and maybe you could give me some advice how Chinese medicine and acupuncture could help me with this rather difficult condition that I seem to have found myself in.
Yeah, how long ago were you diagnosed?
It was in the middle of May, although I have had all kinds of symptoms since last June. It's a very difficult condition to diagnose. So they said I had pneumonia, then they said I had pleurisy, and then it was a bronchitis. And in the meantime, I had a lot of pain. And really, the only way to diagnose this is do biopsy, which is what they did in the end, and that's what they say I have.
Okay.
In the left chest cavity, it's the pleura.
Yeah, you know, I don't know how common that is. I mean, I've treated, you know, helped patients that have mesothelioma, and we should probably back up a little bit. It's a type of cancer that develops in the lining that covers the, actually that covers a few organs of the body, but we think about
correct.
It, I think about it mostly with the lung. Now that's mostly, traditionally, I mean if you, you know, late night TV, they've got lots of attorneys there talking about the mesothelioma lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but the most common site is in the pleura, that outer lining, you know, the pleura, you know, where we would get pleurisy and that rubbing. Did you have a large asbestos exposure that you're aware of?
Well, not that I am. Well, I really don't know, and I understand now that I've looked into it that, like people who have secondhand smoke, can get lung cancer.
Yes.
You don't have to be the person necessarily who has had the exposure to asbestos. It could be a family member bringing it home.
Correct. Did anybody, do you have any family members that you're aware of with that?
Well, could be my dad when I was a kid, could be my ex-husband as a mechanic, could be also the same person working on family vehicles. Because
brake lining,
you know,
the old brake lining
was
horrible.
So it could be anything.
Yeah, I got a lot of exposure. I used to do, my dad was did home remodeling on weekends. He was a welder during the week, but I would go work jobs with him, and of course, I would get all the climbing around in the attic jobs, and the insulation used to be asbestos, and I've had a few lung problems that I attribute to that.
Mm-hmm.
Back to your question, I have there is nothing that I am aware of, but I have not looked through the Chinese literature specifically for that. There's nothing that I'm aware of that would treat that condition directly. Now, there are lots of things that can be done to support overall health to deal with this. And do you have a lot of fluid buildup?
I did have, but I think currently I don't.
And I have treated patients who had a lot of fluid buildup, some of them who had even gone through the talc scarring procedure where
mm-hmm.
they put talcum powder basically in there. They don't call it that. But they put it in there to work on that. And I have worked with a few patients with that. So the fluid issues I have dealt with and the support issues I have dealt with, but I've never treated specifically the condition that you're talking about. there is one fellow, I don't know if he's still alive, actually, one fellow in Chicago, a Chinese doctor, who did a lot of work with different types of lung cancers. And I'm spacing on his name a little bit. Maybe it'll come back to me. It was Sam, but I don't remember his last name. And he had a lot of very interesting formulas to support the lungs. One of the things that is always good for general lung support is the mushroom family. And I would recommend, if you haven't already, looking at Paul Stamets' work, S-T-A-M-E-T-S, his work, looking at particularly turkey tail mushrooms, but a variety of other medicinal mushrooms, which have some very near miraculous-looking results with lung issues and with different forms of cancers. So that's the first place I would look. But for me personally, all I would be able to offer is some type of supportive care, either for the fluid buildup or the general weakness that tends to come.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately,
well, I think that really is what I was looking for. You know, some kind of support.
Oh yeah, we do a lot of that. You know, in not just in California, in the United States, the treatment of cancers is very, very, very restricted from people in all fields. And in Chinese medicine, we are not allowed to diagnose, treat, or cure cancer. In the same paragraph, though, of that finding, it says that we are absolutely allowed to give supportive care. And so that's what we do a lot of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of supportive care available in the Bay Area from acupuncturists and herbalists for these conditions. And we can do a lot to build immunity and to build what we would call chi flow and blood flow through the lungs, and also keep down the fluid buildup. So we're very good at that in general.
Yes, well, that's what I would be asking you to do, because medically it's either two surgeries or radiation or chemotherapy. You know, there's really not much else you can do.
No, and I think the mesotheliomas don't all, I mean, it tends to be a little diffuse, so the surgeries are tough.
Mm-hmm.
Is yours very localized,
very,
or is it fairly diffuse, spread out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And so those are tricky. And again, I would certainly not give any suggestion that we can heal the original lesions, but certainly, absolutely, you could get very, very good supportive care. And dietary issues even play a role in that, too. There are many foods that are very supportive of lung function, and, you know, keeping the oxygen exchange high in the lungs. And there are other foods that aren't so good, and so that's a big thing, too. Obviously, you want to load up with antioxidants, which will help deal with the oxidative stress, you know, from the cancer itself.
Right, right. So any of that kind of support, I would be very grateful for.
Well, I would be happy to meet with you. Hmm. And I, you know, if I interview you and talk to you and go through your history, and if I feel like I'm the best person for you, I'd love to treat you. And if I feel I'm not the best person, I'll find someone that I think is.
Okay, well, thank you. That's fair enough. Do I call you?
Yeah, I just call my office. And I usually don't, you know, even give out my number and things like that, because I don't want to try to enlist patients over the air type of thing.
Okay.
But
in
your case, I think it would be worth coming to see me at least once, so we can kind of figure out all of what's going on, and then at least I can direct you.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you can call my office. That number is 510 814 6900.
Okay. Thank you so much.
And thank you for calling,
Carolyn.
Thank
you also to my friend who suggested that I call you, if she's listening.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Sherry.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And I will be in touch with you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And Carolyn's, you know, absolutely accurate. This is a condition that often it takes a long time to diagnose, because the symptoms can take a while to build up, and there's so many other things that it can mimic. For example, we're right now in the middle of a horrible allergy season. I'm seeing a lot and I mean a lot of allergy sufferers, and so they're coming in with cough and wheezing and maybe some hoarseness, which are some of the symptoms of mesothelioma. They're having some shortness of breath. Again, over half of the people in the United States seek care, you know, drugs usually, but seek some type of care for allergies. So again, this can easily be overlooked. There's shortness of breath. But then you get into the deeper things, and that's generally where it gets diagnosed. Some chest wall pain, more and more difficulty in breathing. Not just shortness of breath, but it actually becomes a little labored. And then if there's blood in the sputum, then that's a definite go to your doctor immediately sign. So, yeah, very difficult. And again, this was primarily associated with asbestos exposures. You know, in the shipyards, for example, in the Bay Area, over here at Kaiser Shipyards, and Kaiser built the Liberty ships, a lot of them, and in Richmond and in the Bay Area. And they, what I've heard is they had huge barrels of asbestos sitting out there, and they would take shovelfuls and throw it because it has several different uses. It's been used, a lot of older homes have asbestos wrap around the furnace or around the ductwork from the furnace, and usually that would be, you'd find out if you had a good home inspection. We had some asbestos in our home. We had some water damage, and the insurance company came out and tested. And the spray-on ceiling coating is before a certain year, I'm going to say 1978, but before the mid-70s, most or at least a lot of that cottage cheese-type ceiling had asbestos in it. And again, asbestos is a good soundproofing. It was used on brakes because it dissipates heat well. It's very slippery, so it was used in the shipyards to make things slide and slip. So it's really an amazing thing unless it gets in your lungs. And other exposures, as I mentioned, are from insulation. So if you're doing any remodeling on an older home and you tear open the walls, you need to be very careful. You need to wear a very, very high-quality respirator because those particles from the asbestos, the problem is they're so tiny and they're like sharp little splinters sticking in the lungs. And so over time, the lungs will wall that off, and then you get genetic changes in the cells, and it develops into a cancer. So if you're going to do any remodeling, don't scrape off the cottage cheese ceiling if your home was built before, let's say 1980, and don't tear out the walls. Get someone else to do it. It's just not really worth the problems. So, yeah, I want to thank Carolyn for that call. Okay, let's see. Do we have another phone caller on the line? All right. Good morning.
Hi, John.
Hi there. How you doing?
Derek, how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing good.
Are you there?
Calling about facial rejuvenation?
No. It's Eric.
I know. I'm teasing you.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Okay. Well, we did have our ceilings taken down this summer with had asbestos in it, so that was connected. So,
yeah.
But I was gonna ask you about. You said I have older family members with knee pain and things like that, and you said your brother swears by Moravia.
Moravia.
I wonder how much. How much turmeric do you need for the such
kind
of pain?
It really is like so many things. It depends on. On the person, I'm using, for him, I think 3 capsules twice a day, but that's very concentrated. He also puts his, you know, when he doesn't have mine, he will just get straight turmeric and put it in capsules. And I honestly don't know how many capsules he uses when he does that. But when he uses our concentrate, he uses 6 capsules a day. And, you know, it's interesting. There are a couple of articles that have come out recently kind of verifying. It's always fun, you know, when in clinical practice you keep seeing the same things over and over again, and so you start to come to some hypotheses about it, some theories, and then I see articles published where there has been research done, and it validates or invalidates the findings that I see in the clinic. And a couple of those, one was in Peak Fitness magazine a while back, probably April. And it was, I think I saw it on Mercola's site, physical therapy as good as surgery for osteoarthritic knees and torn meniscus also. And so he's talking about physical therapy. And there are other studies showing that acupuncture is often better than physical therapy, even the relief from pain in particular. And so often surgery isn't that good a choice. You know, we tend to leap to it, and particularly for the torn meniscus, you know, because often the doctors say, look, it's torn, there's nothing you can do, so you really should get it cut out. Well, I'll tell you my personal experience, I was convinced of that. I had my right knee done 40 years ago, and it's never been as good as it was before. Now, I'm not saying that that's the norm, but I still am aware of it. My left knee, I was told, you know, went and got x-rayed and had the doctor two different opinions, and they said, oh, definitely, you have to have your left knee done. And that was 30 years ago, and I've never had that knee done, and it bothers me less than my other knee. And basically, I started analyzing my gait and looking how I was shifting my weight, and then started doing a lot of Chinese herbs and a few supplements. And, you know, it was amazing. You know, and you, when you're talking about pain relief, you mentioned certainly turmeric or curcumin, which is very, very effective as an anti-inflammatory. Also boswellia, sometimes called Indian frankincense. You know, the frankincense and myrrh, are, by the way, which are both good for inflammation. Boswellia or frankincense has a little more research done it, but they're both fabulous, and they are right at the top of my list for arthritic types of inflammation and pain. And for years, I would put together a formula that I called gold, frankincense, and myrrh, kind of giving it a little biblical reference.
Yeah.
And that was frankincense and myrrh, which are Ruisheng and Moyao in Chinese medicine, very well-known herbs. That's why they were given as a gift. They were so valuable because they were the best at dealing with pain and injuries, really, in the Chinese pharmacopoeia and the whole East and Middle East. So I would do frankincense and myrrh, and then I would add gold, which was in Chinese Zhang Huang, which is turmeric, which is bright yellow gold toward the orange area. But anyway, so I would make gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and my patients love me because it's really, really effective. Now, sometimes...
How did you, John, how did you do that? As a powder? How did you give it to your patients?
I just got them and mixed them. You could get that at most probably any good herbal formulary that carries powdered herbs. You could cook them yourselves if you wanted, but it's a lot easier to do as a powdered capsule. Those are all available as 5-to-1 extracts, and probably, again, you'd use about 6 capsules a day of that to start with. If that didn't work, then you might go up a little bit. Other things that have been found to be very effective for arthritic knees and knee pain, again, astaxanthin, you know, which you know I use from krill oil, but there are other sources. And in one study that I saw, over 60% of arthritis pain sufferers improve just with astaxanthin. So that's pretty amazing. And I tell patients, you know, use lots of fish oil, cod liver oil, krill oil. Pretend it's like an oil, like you're oiling your joints up, and it really starts to feel that way. People get a lot of relief. Then you've got hyaluronic acid, or HA, which holds fluid in the cartilage. It kind of moves nutrients into and out of the matrix, so it's kind of getting rid of the waste products and bringing the nutrients in. And I find that it's really, really great to improve the blood supply to that cartilage. And then we have, you know, the old standbys, chondroitin and glucosamine. So that's kind of where I would start. And I have found that using some combination of those things, and the more the merrier, works far better than any other therapies that I've seen. And again, acupuncture is very effective for that.
And boswellia, I guess you can use that, quite a few capsules of that as well.
I would, again, I can't really say how much to use because there's so many different extractions percentages that you can get. Most of my herbs are 5-to-1 extracts, although the caveat is that's not really true because some things like shells and heavy things you really can't extract. So it's not quite accurate, but the companies will put on them 5-to-1 extract. And that's what I use typically. There are other companies that will have those 10-to-1 extracts or even more. So, you know, you would need less and less volume to get the desired effect.
Can you explain the 5-to-1? I'm not exactly sure.
Well, if you take
5 pounds
of herbs and you cook it down and end up with 1 pound of sludge.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
So the assumption being that you're extracting it down, and hopefully, if it's done properly, and there's a whole art to this. It's called powdure. Powdure is the art of preparing. I'm going to call it, at this point, Chinese medicinals, but other cultures certainly have the same concepts. But the Chinese powdure is incredibly, incredibly well thought out and experimented with, because each herb will have different ways to process it that bring out the medicinal qualities more effectively and also get rid of some of the toxic qualities. I've talked on the show about futsa, aconite. Well, aconite, if you just go pick out an aconite root and eat it, you'll die. It's highly poisonous, and it has to go through a multi-step procedure to make it safe. And if it's done properly, it's completely safe. And it is the best herb, in fact, the only herb that does the specialized function that it does with that level of success. And, you know, kind of really restoring kidney function in Chinese medicine or adrenal function in Western medicine. And there is nothing that is as effective that I've ever seen as good quality futsa. But if you don't process it correctly, it could kill somebody. So this whole idea of powder, you know, how do you cook the herbs? Do you cook them in wine? Do you cook them in vinegar? Do you cook them with salt? Each of those different processing methodologies use different biochemical qualities. If you cook in wine, traditionally that's used to make the herbs more accessible, to increase blood flow, to increase digestive capacity. So each of the, and you cook it with salt, and that then has more of an affinity for the kidney system. So there's a very, very well thought out art and science to that. So again, when you buy a 5-to-1 extract of an herb, you're really relying on the company that processed it to know what the heck they're doing. And a lot of the herbs are just water decoctions. You just boil, you know, you bring the water to a boil, you cook the herbs for a certain period of time. But some herbs are much more effective as an alcohol extraction, say done with a tincture. And there are a couple of Chinese herbs, a couple of herbs that have usages now that are quite different than the traditional usages of those herbs. And the reason is that it's not that they are suddenly discovering new usages for the same animal necessarily. It's that they are using different extraction methodologies, where they might have been done as a water decoction traditionally in Chinese medicine. They are finding, you know, with new studies, that if you do an alcohol extraction, you get completely different sets of alkaloids. For example, the cooking procedure might destroy some of the biochemical properties of some herbs, but an alcohol extraction may enhance them. So again, it's a tremendous art, and that's why when I see people doing their own herbs, that's okay. That's fine, because they're generally safe, but don't ever expect to get the same results that you would get from a really, really experienced herbalist, because there's so much, and I mean an astonishing amount to know about, not just the herbs, but about how to process them.
I'm getting big, great pictures of huge herbal farms somewhere, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. They are huge. I was at a meeting last week in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, for the CCAOM, which is the Council of Colleges of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. And we meet a couple times a year, and it's really great. You know, we're looking at different legislative issues and educational issues for the colleges. One of the things, though, that is so powerful is you get all of these people who are really old-timers in the business. Most have been around for a long time. They've seen a lot. They're very knowledgeable practitioners. And so the dialogues are very, very interesting. And one of the things that's happening, there are a couple of women that have been spearheading this effort for quite a while to really promote the growth of these herbs in the United States. And one of the women that was a student at our school, Renee Klorman, her friend, Peg Schaefer, have been doing some great work. I buy herbs from them whenever I can. They grow them fairly locally. Now, the thing is, each of these herbs, as any gardener knows, has affinities for certain types of soil, certain types of sun, certain temperature ranges. So there are a lot of herbs that just won't grow in the Bay Area, but there are quite a few that will. And so what these women are doing is going around the country, speaking at different colleges and trying to get people turned on to the idea of creating their own herb farms and then farms that they can then share with other people in the country. And they're doing a really, really fine job. So more and more, we are able to get organic, locally grown herbs. Again, nowhere near the quantity or the variety that we can get from China, but it is building. I made a couple of medicinal brandies for gifts this year from herbs that I bought from Peg Schaefer. Are you there, Eric?
Yep, sure, okay. I am. Yep. That's fine. That's very interesting. Could you take it in a different direction? You mentioned just at the end of one of your programs recently about ketones or ketosis and diabetes. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. When the body, so the preferred fast fuel for the body's cellular functioning is glucose, a sugar, a simple sugar. So table sugar, sucrose, is typically about half glucose and about half fructose. But glucose is what is utilized mostly in the human body. And the insulin system is then is involved with glucose metabolism. So essentially, having insulin available helps, and again, this isn't biochemically correct, but it kind of escorts the sugar molecule across the cell membranes so that they can go into the cell to be burned as energy in the mitochondria, these little energy factories, which are pretty amazing, little processing units. And so in that system, you need both insulin and glucose to be in the blood, and you need an absence of resistance in the cells to bringing that glucose in. And so what happens as one becomes diabetic, again, diabetic is just a term. It really is a legal definition, really a medical definition, that one has blood sugars above 125 units or a hemoglobin A1C above a certain level. So these are just kind of definitions. But what occurs is that because the main cause, there are others, but because there is too much glucose in the blood, too much glucose, blood sugar available, the cells become resistant. It's kind of like they're saying, look, we cannot take any more of this sugar in here. You know, it will destroy the cell. So what happens is the membranes around the cell, the phospholipid membranes, become resistant. And it takes then more and more insulin to bring that sugar into the cells. And so what occurs then in type 2 diabetes, adult onset diabetes, if you check the blood, you have high levels of blood sugar, but also high levels of insulin because the body is working harder and harder to try to bring that blood sugar in. Now, in what's called typically juvenile onset or type 1 or autoimmune diabetes, which tends to hit children more often, although that's changing, you would have high blood sugar but low insulin because the pancreas is not creating enough insulin. But in adults, the pancreas is working overtime until it finally gives out, and so you'd have high insulin and high glucose. Now, if the body cannot burn sugar, which happens in this case, then it will start burning fat. And while it's great to burn fat, if you're only burning fat, well, whenever fat is burned, it gives off what are called ketones or ketone bodies. Oh. And those ketones, very low levels are fine. In fact, the brain actually likes ketones to a certain level. But if those build up too much, it causes what's called ketoacidosis. The body becomes thrown out of balance on a pH, and it becomes too acidic. And so when that happens, eventually patients will die because of that imbalance in the pH system, and also because they're starving to death because they're not getting the blood sugars burned. Does that help?
Yeah. Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, I appreciate that. And let me thank you for your show again, and we're fortunate to have you on the radio out here, I think.
So, oh,
we appreciate it very much.
I really appreciate that, Eric. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Okay, you too. Yeah. Fun questions. You know, I mentioned the Mercola article where he was talking about physical therapy, but also being better than surgery, or as good as surgery, I think is how he titled it. But if it's as effective and you don't have risk, I consider it better. And so he was looking at some of the problems there and looking at ways to ameliorate that with pain-relieving supplements. And I would throw in there acupuncture, which is very, very effective at dealing with that type of pain. It's one of the things, it's the second most common thing that is treated with Chinese medicine in the United States is pain, and then orthopedic injury. Both of those are right at the top. And number one in the United States is anxiety. That's the number one thing that we treat. Other studies that sort of apply to this, there was a study done, I'm looking at it here, I have it in front of me. It was published in Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, in February of 2013. But I pulled this one up, was reading it yesterday, and it says double fault, the play on words here, no long-term benefit of corticosteroid injection or PT for tennis elbow. At 1 year, corticosteroid injection actually had worse outcomes than a placebo. So it wasn't just neutral, it actually was worse. And again, clinically, I've seen this over and over and over again for many, many years. The patients will go in, they'll get corticosteroid injections. They feel great for a little while because it's shutting off the inflammation and it's shutting off the healing process, so they don't have any pain. And then they go out and start playing tennis again, and they end up worse than they were before. So this is very significant because we also know that corticosteroid injections are very problematic for a variety of other long-term health conditions, particularly in women. And also, this one was interesting because they said physical therapy didn't help much. Now, that makes a lot of sense because if you have tennis, what's called tennis elbow, and it's really from doing a bad backhand at tennis. There's also golfer's elbow. So tennis elbow is where the lateral epicondyle, that's the bone on the outside of the elbow, gets inflamed, and the area around it gets inflamed, and it's very, very, very painful. You can barely function if it's really bad. If the pain is on the medial epicondyle, the bone near the funny bone on the inside of the elbow, that's often called golfer's elbow, and that's because that's done from an improper, will happen with an improper golf stroke where you're turning the thumb side of the forearm inward, like when you're swinging a club. If you over-rotate the elbow, you get golfer's elbow, whereas if you over-rotate the elbow outward or improperly rotate it, then you get tennis elbow. Same condition, just on opposite sides of the arm. Well, if you do physical therapy for that, that's great. However, if you haven't fixed the underlying problem, which certainly corticosteroids don't do, and apparently from this study, physical therapy often doesn't do, then it's not going to get any worse. Now, I have personally found this is an area where acupuncture is phenomenal. Now, all of the things that I mentioned, all of those supplements that would be useful for knee pain and osteoarthritis of the knee even, would also be effective for tennis elbow because we have to get the inflammation down, and those natural anti-inflammatories are extremely effective for that. So certainly you'd want to do that. A massage as well as PT would get rid of the short-term problems. It would also help to move the blood in the area, particularly if you get good orthopedic massage or Tuina massage. It will break down some of the scar tissue and adhesions. My favorite methodology, and I ended up having to do this with my wife a few years ago, right after my son was born, because she had forearm tendonitis so bad that she couldn't even turn keys in the lock, and she couldn't turn the handle on the door. So for that, I use a threading technique. So I'll take actually very long needles, about 6 inches. This is a very non-painful treatment, very non-painful. But we thread the needles, or I thread the needles, right down alongside the tendon on both sides. And then I do electroacupuncture through that. Now, that's a very, very important and significant distinction. I see a lot of patients who have been treated for these elbow problems by someone who really isn't an orthopedic acupuncturist, and they don't get a lot of relief. And the reason for that is if you put a needle at, say, down toward the wrist, and you put another needle up toward the elbow, and you do electroacupuncture, that does some very beneficial things. However, when we test resistance or what's called impedance through body tissue, which is very easy to measure, we find that at the areas of pain and at the areas of injury, there is a much, I mean, dramatically higher level of impedance or resistance to electromagnetic flow. So if you put a needle at the, say, 10 inches apart on the arm and you put electricity through it, the electricity will actually go around. The current will go around the injury. It won't go through it because the surrounding tissues have much lower resistance, so it's easier for the current to go through it than it is to go through the injury. So I have found that if I actually put the needle exactly adjacent, right against the tendon, and I do it for about 6 inches on each side of the tendon or either side of the tendon, and then do electroacupuncture, it sort of captures that electromagnetic injury, and it has to go through the tendon, or much easier to go through the tendon. And you can actually tell if it's working because over time, the settings that you need to use for the intensity of current will go down. So I might at the beginning have to use 600 to 800 milliamps, and after a few treatments, that may go down to 200 milliamps, which tells me that I'm needing a lot less force, a lot less intensity to get the electromagnetic energy from that device to go through the tendon. And studies have shown that that type of treatment can increase the chemical levels at the area of the injury, primarily a chemical called adenosine, A-D-E-N-O-S-I-N-E, which is kind of one of the numerical things that Western medicine is trying to find drugs to do. Well, all you have to do is stick a needle in somebody. Just sticking a needle with no skill, actually, into a point will increase the adenosine levels. And that's why we see in some of the so-called sham acupuncture studies or fake acupuncture, where they actually stuck a needle in the body at the wrong point, it was still effective because it will increase the adenosine levels and change the biochemistry. However, if you do it in the right location and you do it with the right electromagnetic energy flow, you'll get an increase of about 25 times in the adenosine levels, and that is really significant. And it will then actually heal the underlying tissues. And what I find is that up to a certain point, so if I press on the arm and the tendons hurt when I press on them, that's very easy to treat. That may be one treatment, maybe two. If I press on the bone and it's excruciating, then what's happening is that it's starting to cause a separation in some of the tissues on the lining, the periosteum, around the bone, and that takes a little bit longer to heal. In fact, if that is not treated, I've seen it last for over a year. Even after patients stopped doing tennis or whatever it was that was causing it, I've seen it take up to a year for that heal or over a year for that to heal. One thing is you'll find that you're bumping your elbows a lot more than you realized. If you don't have pain, you don't notice it. But if you have pain, you notice that, oh, my God, every time I walk somewhere, I'm hitting my elbows. So I have found electroacupuncture used properly with a threading technique along with Chinese herbs, Ruxiang, Moyao, Zhanghuang, so that would be turmeric, frankincense, myrrh, and a few other herbs. I have found those to be the most effective ways to treat that. We would also use an external liniment, so that would be herbs that are soaked typically in an alcohol solution for some period of time. There's the old HIT medicines, or the D-dot Jiaos, which were, you know, they're old formulas from the Shaolin monasteries, where these guys were beating each other up with sticks and their martial arts and breaking bones and stuff, and they came up with some great formulas to use externally to also help the blood flow and help the healing. So we do herbs internally, we do herbs externally, we do antioxidants internally and oils, and then we do electroacupuncture. And it is by far the best, fastest way I have seen for people to heal those injuries. And it, for those of you that have been listening, I am not, you know, if I thought there was something else that was better, if I thought surgery was better, I'd tell you, you know, but it's not. And I just realized I did not give out the phone number here at the show, so some of you are probably trying to call in, but you don't know where to call. I apologize. The number here at the show is area code 415-431-8255. So that's area code 415-431-8255. And let's go take another phone call. Hi.
Hi, John. It's Kent.
Kent, I was wondering where you were.
Huh?
Hi there.
There I was, yes. Sometime I'll have to sit and talk to you about voltage and current, because there's some details about you were given that I'm not sure about, but I don't think we have enough time for that.
That's great, because I just talk about it from what I do, turning the dials on the machine, and I would love to be more accurate in my explanation, so I'd love to talk with you about it.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, I used to do electrical work on houses,
right.
You know, looking at voltage, amperage, resistance and stuff, but I'm a novice. So I'd love to talk with you.
Well, you'll go by just whatever terms and that your coworkers are using. So,
yep.
Anyway, yeah. Thanks for the comments on maleness on your topical broadcast.
Oh, yeah. That's a repeat. I did that once before, and that show got more responses than any show I've ever done.
Yes, I'm not surprised. Like men in general, especially young men, are so attacked just for being male and made to feel bad or wrong for being male that maleness is something needs fixing.
Well, you know, I'll talk to women a lot. I mean, most of my practice are women, and they'll come in and they'll, you know, complain about their husbands and boyfriends, and, you know, I will listen and stuff, and I'll say, oh, by the way, is your husband a man? And they'll look at me with this kind of shocked look, and they go, yeah. I said, well, then don't expect him to change. That is part of his being a male, just as, and I'll name four or five qualities, is a product of your being female. So, you know, you may like him, you may not like him, you may like his behaviors or not like them, but there's a certain fundamental way of seeing and holding reality that isn't going to change. And they
right.
kind of freaked out because they keep hoping.
Well, they think, yeah, there's an old saying, men... women marry men thinking they will change. Men marry women thinking they will stay the same. Both are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So it's So thank you for that. Now, by the way, have you ever heard of you're going to have like a facial acupuncture and facial rejuvenation thing? Have you ever heard of using a jade pillow cover?
Oh yeah. And jade, actually, I didn't mention it. Jade rollers. We have little rollers that we use in this treatment also, and I forgot that. Yeah, jade pillows were a big deal. I mean, you know, jade was so revered in the Orient as a giver of energy and, you know, the qualities of it. So there are actually jade rollers that are used in this treatment.
Right, and my wife and I were in China once. We actually bought a couple of jade pillow covers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't, you know, I'm hoping we were at a reputable place. I don't know if there's an easy way to tell that it was a genuine jade. I think we were pretty confident that it was genuine jade, so...
Mm-hmm.
But okay, so that is widely revered. Okay,
it is, yeah. And the wealthier people were, the more they used jade for a lot of different things, you know, for energetic stuff, but certainly for cellular rejuvenation.
Okay.
You know, Kent, I'm so happy you mentioned that. I actually brought the book today because I keep giving wrong attribution to the writer of the book, and I'm sure she doesn't listen to my show, but if she ever does, I apologize sincerely. The book that I allude to is The Male Brain by Luann Brizendine, Brizendine. And my wife just read this recently, and she was very tripped out. She's pretty hip to a lot of this stuff. And she hears me talk about it. She studies it a lot, and she has an 11-year-old son. But she read this book and was just stunned, thinking, oh, my God. No wonder Johnny does this,
yes.
Right? Which she thought were kind of, you know, he's a great kid, but she was thinking, well, gosh, why does he do this stupid thing? Well, it really comes out, and there's one section here that I've talked about for a while,
And it's the male brain and sexual orientation, because I didn't talk to this so much there. And, you know, I had spoken about how there was a study done showing that if they took a female rat and they looked at their brain, right, they took the skull off, and if they introduced testosterone to that rat, that the nerve fibers that were going across the anterior commissure, and the, you know, which I learned by another name, but as it's, they would actually turn around and go back. And so it's not an accident that men don't process information that way. It's actually critical for survival. And in her book, she points out that, I'm going to actually read this because I brought it in today. It says, one of the early studies by Dick Swab found that a part of the hypothalamus called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, please don't remember that, is twice as large in gay males as in straight males. This difference was later shown to be caused by a difference in the way testosterone reacts with the developing brain. And then it goes on to later to talk about this anterior commissure, which is the super fast cables that connect the two hemispheres of the brain, is also much larger in women. And so we start looking at these things, and it explains so much about orientation in this reality. You know, if the cabling is different, if the wiring is different, and again, in straight males, there's a lot less throughput. There's less signal traffic, which has a benefit because you're not distracted by all that background signal input. So for singular activities like hunting or fighting or those that or driving or parking a car
or putting activities,
that's
aside
really
distractions.
However, for having a broader and more accepting relationship to reality and social stuff, it's really a hindrance, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's really, you know, we look at these things and they're hard. A lot of them are hardwired in.
But we also have this weirdness that so many people, they're environmentalists, so we must love nature. It's beautiful as it is. Don't change it, except for men.
Mm-hmm.
They need fixing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, tell me about it. In my field, that's a common topic of conversation. But, yeah, this is such a quick read. I really urge, this is a fun read. She did a great job of making it non-technical. Now, when I read that passage, there were a few technical terms, but she has things like dad's tending instinct, a dad is made, right, the daddy brain. And so it's really fascinating to me, like these really simple things that help explain so much about how we function in reality. So anyway, I love it. Actually, it's fun because half of the book is endnotes. So she definitely did her research. But it's a fun, you know, you can probably pick this up now for a couple bucks now.
Okay.
She's got one here. It says, Squirming Boys Learn Better.
Uh-huh.
That's an interesting one. Squirming boys actually learn better. And what do we do in our culture? We try to get those squirming boys to stop squirming,
right?
Which we do, but they actually have more difficulty learning there. And, you know, I've said many times that our education system, as it is now designed, is really designed for female learners. And it's one of the reasons that boys are having so much difficulty.
Right. That's one thing that I'll compliment my wife about. She's very accepting of male behavior. And so, for the longest time, she was in a circle of friends where she was basically the only woman that was usually there. And she said, oh, yeah, they're pigs, so what? You know.
Cool.
Anyway, go ahead.
No, I was wondering if you had a question today.
Yes, if we have time.
I think I have about 4 minutes.
Okay. How about a short one? Are you going to have a seminar on that protocol for relieving sleep apnea?
I didn't have one planned, but I certainly could.
Oh, I thought you were talking about maybe doing one doing acupressure or something so people could maybe treat their own.
I probably did say that. You know, I have such a short little span of attention as I'm sitting here squirming in my seat.
That's right.
Being
yes.
a boy. But thank you for reminding me. That is something that would be really valuable to do, and I'm going to put that on my to-do list.
Now, in your memory, does it have to do with, opening up or toning up the muscles in that area or toning up the tissue?
The technique
that I have adopted from the Brazilian study, which I have found to be better than the technique that I had made up on my own, is very involved. Every point that this woman uses, I also, that's not true. Every point that I had used is in her protocol, but she's basically doubled the number of points that I had used. So it's very interesting. So she's working on the spleen system, which would work on phlegm, damp, stagnation, and energetic stuff, and the lung system she works on, and then quite a few local points around the throat, or more, I'll say, local points around the throat, but also points for the sinuses. So it's a really comprehensive treatment. And I don't remember how many needles right now, but it's probably close to 20. And from the top of the head all the way down to the feet, very, very thorough. So it's working on quite a few different systems. And I don't know if she did that to make it, to hit, because, you know, different people's apnea has different causes.
Right.
And some of it's weight, some of it's dampness, some of it's sinus, some of it's central sleep apnea. And so I don't know if she designed it this way purposely so it would hit everything, but I use it and it's very effective.
Okay, because I was wondering if like part of it was like something to tone the tissue, maybe something to reduce the swelling in the tongue, that
there,
sort of
there
thing.
There definitely are those. Again, the spleen points would be very important, and the kidney points that are used, very important to reduce the size of the tongue, to reduce that swelling, because they would increase the chi flow, which increases the movement of those fluids. So that's for sure part of the protocol. So there are also points right in the throat and to tone those muscles.
Okay.
So, yeah, you're right on track.
Okay. Well, I'd be very interested in knowing about that because this, you know, it sounds a lot more, if it can replace a CPAP machine, it sounds a lot better than a CPAP machine. So.
Yeah, no kidding. And that's what she found, is that the reduction was very significant. Now, I'm not doing a controlled study, but I have had a couple of people report just pretty remarkable results.
Okay.
Yep.
Thanks,
okay, Kent.
Well, thank you. Talk to
you
later.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to sign off. I want to thank you all for tuning in. And if you missed the show yesterday, it is podcast, and it's a really fun show. It's really about male-female hormonal issues, but primarily I spend a lot more time talking about men than I ever do otherwise. And it's really, I think I've gotten a lot of feedback on the show. So thank you for listening. I'll be back next Saturday. Thank you very much. Be happy. Be healthy.